This lecture series is from learningiplaw.com. Visit the learningiplaw.com website to see other lecture series about intellectual property. This lecture series is entitled The Basic U.S. Trademark Application Process. The lecturer is Professor Carl Opedal. Professor Opedal has been a practicing intellectual property attorney for over two decades and is the founder of the Opedal Patent Law Firm, LLC. He earned his BA in physics and mathematics from Grinnell College and his JD from Harvard Law School. He has taught as an adjunct professor at Cardozo Law School and at University of Denver Law School. He is the author of several books and many professional articles. He has served as the chair of the Electronic Business Committee of the American Intellectual Property Law Association and as the chair of the Patent Cooperation Treaty Issues Committee of that association. This lecture series includes a study outline. You may find it helpful to review the outline during each lecture or at the end of each lecture. Listening to these lectures does not make Professor Opedal your lawyer and does not make you his client. If you want legal advice, you should consult competent counsel who can render advice based upon your factual situation. The audio files and study outline that make up this lecture series are protected by copyright, and the unauthorized duplication thereof is a violation of law. Under the license terms for this lecture series, the purchaser is permitted to make use of these audio files in much the same way as a physical book is used. Just as the purchaser of a book can pass along the book to be read by someone else, but is not permitted to make a copy of the book that is being passed along, so the purchaser of this set of audio files is permitted to pass along the audio files to someone else, but is not permitted to retain a copy of the audio files. If you are the purchaser of this set of audio files, thank you for your financial support. If you are not the purchaser, but did receive the audio files in a manner consistent with this license, then we welcome you to the lecture series.
I'm Carl Opedal. Welcome to this lecture series on the United States trademark application process. Before we start our study of the United States trademark application process, we need to learn a little bit about how it works in all the other countries of the world. The way it works in almost all the other countries of the world is that a trademark owner files a trademark application. The trademark office looks to see whether anybody has registered that same trademark for the same goods or services. If no previous filings are found that conflict, the trademark office publishes the application for opposition. Members of the public are then given the opportunity, if they wish, to file opposition for one reason or another. And if nobody files opposition, or if the opposition proceeding finishes in favor of the applicant, the mark goes to registration. There are some countries where the process is even more abbreviated than what I just described. There are some countries that do not even take the time to look to see whether there was any previous conflicting filing, other than perhaps an extremely simple database lookup to see if an absolutely identical mark has been filed in the exact same trademark class. We will talk about trademark classes a little later, but sometimes the initial processing of the application is very, very limited, and it simply gets published for opposition, and then if nobody files opposition, the trademark is registered. There are other countries around the world where there isn't even any publication mechanism, where all you do is file, and the trademark office just grants the registration essentially instantly based on what was filed. In most of the countries that I'm referring to, there will be mechanisms where a member of the general public could ask to have a registration canceled. Why? because they think maybe the owner of the registration is not really using the trademark. And if the trademark is not really being used, maybe the registration will be canceled, and then it would be possible for somebody else to apply for a trademark registration for the same mark. But in most of the countries around the world, the process is roughly what I've described, and these are called registration systems, and you typically do not need to prove that you've ever actually used the trademark as a precondition of obtaining a registration in most of the countries of the world. The United States, for the first 150 years of its history, only had trademark regulation or trademark enforcement to the extent that individual states of the United States chose to regulate or enforce trademarks. That is to say, for a substantial fraction of our country's history, there was no federal trademark system. Anybody who felt like they wanted to register a trademark would go to the state capital of whatever state they were interested in and file a trademark application in that state, typically with the Secretary of State or whatever government agency is responsible for regulating corporations and other newly formed businesses. To this day, approximately 35 states out of our 50 states continue to have trademark offices, much like what I described. And you can go to a state capital in any of those approximately 35 states, file a trademark application, and typically have it granted a few minutes later, typically granted later the same day. The application process in most of those states simply involves filing a trademark application, paying a very modest fee. The trademark office in that state does nothing more than check to see if an absolutely identical trademark has been registered, and if it hasn't, a registration will be granted. This was the situation in the United States through over the first 100 years of the history of the United States. We should pause for a minute and ask ourselves, why do we have trademark law at all? What are the purposes of trademark law? The answer that is traditionally given is that the purpose of trademark law is consumer protection. The purpose of trademark law is to permit consumers to make purchases, to make buying decisions with some confidence that they know the origin of the goods that they are purchasing. The idea here is that we don't want somebody to be able to counterfeit goods. We don't want people to be able to make goods and pretend they were made by somebody else. And that we are protecting consumers if we provide legal systems, legal mechanisms for guarding against false designations of origin, guarding against situations where somebody palms off their goods as if they were the work of somebody else. Those are the stated purposes of the trademark systems in most countries and in most of the states of the United States. Stated purpose is to protect consumers from confusion. Having said this, I suppose what we should do is spend a moment or two to recognize that the reality and the stated purposes are sometimes different. The reality of many trademark systems, if only we were honest about it, is not so much to protect consumers, but instead to permit corporations, companies, to accumulate legally enforceable rights and to use those legally enforceable rights against others, including using those rights against their competitors. That real function of trademark systems in many countries and in many states of the United States is simply to protect property rights of established businesses. As we talk about the application process for a U.S. trademark registration, we will go back and touch on some of the things that I've just mentioned. We will from time to time remind ourselves how trademark systems work in some other countries around the world. We will talk from time to time about how trademark registration activities take place in the trademark offices of particular states within the United States. But the chief focus of this lecture series will be to become familiar with the application process for registering trademarks in the Federal Trademark Office, the United States Patent and Trademark Office in Alexandria, Virginia. Usually when somebody says, "I have a trademark," somebody who's located in the United States, usually what they mean is, "I have a federal trademark registration." Usually when somebody says, "I have a trademark and I can use it to enforce it against somebody else," usually what people mean is, "I will use my federal trademark registration as a weapon to enforce my rights against others." That the federal trademark registration is somehow a very important indication of trademark rights somehow granted by the federal government. But what I think is going to be important to pay attention to over the next couple of lectures in this series is that in a very important sense, a federal trademark registration means almost nothing. That a federal trademark registration really only means that somebody satisfied a number of procedural requirements and received a document with a gold seal on the front. But to the extent somebody actually has enforceable trademark rights, the accumulation of those enforceable trademark rights actually comes from other places, comes from other activity, comes from something other than filling out an application and prosecuting paperwork before the federal government. That the real way people accumulate trademark rights is actually by using the mark. In the United States, in the substantive law of the 50 states that make up the United States, people accumulate trademark rights by actual use. That's how people really get enforceable rights. If there are two people in the courtroom fighting over something, and one of them has only a piece of paper and nothing else, a piece of paper with a gold seal, and if the other of the two people can point to actual trademark use, actual past activity, that's the party who may well win the case. Merely having a piece of paper with a gold seal on the front, when the person on the other side of the case has been actually using the mark, and if the person with the gold seal actually hasn't been using the mark hardly at all, or maybe not at all, the one who's been actually using the mark may well be the one that will prevail in court. So now, what name do we give to the trademark rights that you get from actual use? We call them common law trademark rights. We sometimes call them state law trademark rights. If somebody has been using a mark in a particular state, we may say that they have common law rights in that state. We may say that they have substantial common law rights in that state. Although some companies spend enormous amounts of time and energy to pursue the trademark application process to get U.S. trademark registrations, the fact is that there are plenty of companies that have never bothered to file a trademark application and that have very, very strong trademark rights, very, very strong enforceable rights in court, merely from having used the mark a lot in commerce. Every now and then, I will stumble upon some large, well-known company, typically a company that lots of people have heard of, maybe even a company that is mentioned in television or in the popular press, and it will turn out that the company is well-known, that the company has strong rights enforceable in court, and yet that the company may not have a federal trademark registration. Just to make the same point in a slightly different way, and I'm repeating it just for emphasis, somebody who has trademark rights and wants to go to court and enforce those rights against somebody else does not have to have a trademark registration from any state nor from the federal government to win their lawsuit. It is commonplace for people to go to court, assert trademark rights against somebody else, and win without any trademark registration granted by any state or by the federal government. Having said this, let's now talk about the federal trademark registration system in the United States. As we will learn over the course of the next few lectures, anybody who wants to can file a trademark application in the United States Patent and Trademark Office. They can prosecute that application through the examination process. They can follow it as it gets published for opposition. They can have a grant of a registration, and they can obtain a federal trademark registration. And in doing so, they get to use an R in a circle. They get to say, I have a federal trademark. They get to wave this document in the face of other people and try to convince them to stop doing whatever they're doing. Where does this federal trademark system come from? Well, this turns out to be a non-negligible question. The United States is a federation. The United States is made up of 50 states. The United States is limited in its powers by the U.S. Constitution. There are a lot of things the federal government simply cannot legally do in the United States. Why? Because the U.S. Constitution explicitly says that other than the enumerated powers that the Constitution gives to the federal government, all other powers are reserved to the individual states. There are many, many reminders of the fact that almost everything about a person's daily existence are in fact determined by the state they happen to be located in, and that not that many things about a person's existence are in fact controlled by the federal government. In particular, nothing about the Constitution gives the federal government any authority to even operate a trademark system. Now, with patents and copyrights, it's very different. You can look in Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, and you find a place where James Madison put into the Constitution that Congress was obligated to pass laws to promote science and the useful arts by protecting patent and copyright rights of inventors and authors. It's right there in the Constitution that the federal government was obligated and continues to be obligated to provide a patent office and to provide a copyright office and to provide legal mechanisms for enforcing patent rights and copyright rights. That's in the Constitution. But you can read the Constitution from the top to the bottom, and you will not find any place where it says that the federal government is supposed to be doing trademark law. You won't find any place in the Constitution where it says the federal government should be operating a trademark office. You won't find a place where it says the federal government should be handing out trademark registrations. No. The Reservations Clause reserves to the individual states of the United States all the powers that are not enumerated in the Constitution as somehow going to the federal government. And that regulation of trademarks for well over the first century of our country's progress, the regulation of trademarks was understood to be the business of the individual states. You know, if you're driving down the highway and you wonder, what is the speed limit? How fast am I allowed to drive? The answer might be different in Montana from what the answer is in Idaho. You might get a different answer in Colorado, still a different answer in Wyoming. The reason is that each of our states has the power to decide how fast you can drive on their highways. And the federal Constitution does not say that the federal government gets to decide how fast people drive. No, that decision is a decision that the individual states are allowed to make. Similarly, with trademarks, for decades, for well over a century, if anybody ever told you what trademark you could or could not use, it was the government of whatever state you happened to be in. So how is it that the federal government, which only has those powers enumerated that are given to it in the Constitution, how can it be that the federal government can do this seemingly unconstitutional thing, which is to purport to regulate trademarks? How can it be that Congress can stick its nose into the business of the 50 states? How can it be that there is a federal trademark office at all? And how can it be that the federal government would be telling people who does or does not get a trademark registration? How can it be that the federal government would issue documents that might affect who wins or loses a lawsuit where trademarks are at stake? What is the answer to all these questions? Well, in a moment I will tell you the answer to all these questions, but before I do, I will say that this answer is not only interesting as a mere intellectual exercise. Yes, you will find it very satisfying, perhaps, to know how it is that a constitution that says that all the powers go to the states would somehow leave some loophole that lets the federal government decide that it is going to control the world of trademarks in the United States. Yes, I will tell you that in a moment, and you may find it interesting. But what I'm about to tell you is that almost everything in this lecture series, everything about it that seems annoying or frustrating or puzzling, almost everything about the application process of applying for a trademark, almost everything about what you have to do to get a trademark, handing in specimens of use, handing in an oath or a declaration stating that the use started on a certain date, all of those things flow from the peculiar thing that I'm about to tell you. Everything about what makes the U.S. trademark system much more cumbersome, much more annoying, much more expensive than the trademark systems in any of the other countries around the world. Everything about the annoyance and the expense follows from what I'm about to tell you. All right, let me tell you. The Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution is the excuse that Congress used to create a federal trademark system. The Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution is what somehow allows the federal government to do something that would otherwise be completely unconstitutional, which is to attempt to usurp from the individual 50 states the power to decide who gets a trademark and who doesn't. It is the Commerce Clause. What is this Commerce Clause? Well, this Commerce Clause, at the time the U.S. Constitution was drafted, the Commerce Clause was a fairly innocuous little collection of words. It basically had something to do with the idea that the federal government should promote commerce across state lines, that the federal government should facilitate shipment of goods across the lines of one state into another state, that the federal government ought to have something to do with what it takes for goods to enter the United States from some other country, and what it might take for goods to leave the United States and be shipped to some other country. The Commerce Clause. Those who have studied constitutional law, those who have made a study of many different phases of our country's history, will recall that the Commerce Clause has been used in other interesting ways to legitimize federal involvement in things that might seem to be purely matters of state law. For example, during the Civil Rights era, when the federal government decided that it was going to desegregate schools, when the federal government decided it was going to desegregate restaurants, bus stations, the Commerce Clause was the excuse. The Commerce Clause was the way that the federal government convinced itself that it had the power to go into some particular state and force a restaurant to allow black people to sit at the same counter with white people. The Commerce Clause was how the federal government decided that it could go to Little Rock, Arkansas and force the desegregation of a school. These kinds of things, the use of some language in an establishing document, here use of language in the U.S. Constitution, as an excuse, as a sort of a hook to hang things on, as a way to enable a federal government to do things that at earlier times people might not have thought the federal government had any authority to do, is a very interesting thing to think about. It's a very interesting thing to think about, and indeed it is exactly what came into the picture when the federal government, when Congress decided to create what we now think of as our federal trademark system. But the fact that this really did involve, perhaps, pushing some boundaries, that this did involve doing things that, if they weren't done right, could conceivably be questioned later, helps to explain many, many of the seemingly bizarre, seemingly peculiar things about the U.S. federal trademark system, especially in the many, many ways that it differs from trademark systems in individual states of the U.S. and in its differences when compared with trademark systems in countries outside of the United States. the fact that the Commerce Clause was the excuse, arguably a somewhat artificial excuse, for the federal government choosing to involve itself in the world of trademarks. Having said this, what kinds of things does the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution cover? When James Madison or Thomas Jefferson wrote that set of words, the Commerce Clause language, they wrote something about interstate commerce of a type which Congress may govern, that interstate commerce is the kind of thing that Congress has the power to regulate. The Constitution presumably limits to this day the ability of the federal government to say anything about commerce between, say, San Francisco and Los Angeles. That anybody who wanted to could ship anything between San Francisco and Los Angeles with anything written on it and any trademark on it, and the federal government would have no power to control that or influence it or stop it. Why? Because it did not involve crossing state lines. Or think of St. Louis, Missouri, and Kansas City, Missouri, two cities that are both in the state of Missouri. And anybody who wanted to ship goods between those two cities could presumably always have shipped between those two cities without having to get any permission from the federal government, and the federal government would not have the power to stop or regulate or control shipments between two such cities. Why? Because they're in the same state. So it's interstate commerce that Congress can govern. It's interstate commerce. Only if things cross state lines is the federal government permitted to poke its nose into the business of trademarks, a business previously controlled only by each of the individual 50 states. The idea that it's interstate commerce that Congress may govern will come up again and again during the next few lectures, and you will see over and over again how something that ought to be simple, some bit of paperwork that should only take a few moments, in fact, takes hours and is easy to get wrong, all because of this business about interstate commerce, which Congress may govern. The application process is an interesting one, and we will talk about it in our next lecture. But before we get to that, I will just talk for a moment about goods and services. The earliest trademarks were trademarks placed by artisans, craftspersons, people who made things and sold them to somebody else. Some of the earliest trademarks were from metalsmiths, people who would shape metal, perhaps into jewelry, perhaps into spoons or forks or knives. And the artisans who made these things would mark them with some kind of mark as a way of showing who made it. And later, when somebody wanted to buy a high-quality knife or a very nice piece of jewelry, well, they might look for that mark. And if they saw the mark, they knew that it had been made by a particular person, and this might be an important part of their purchasing decision as they decide which knife to purchase in the store or something. And this concept, the idea of a mark applied to a product, is what has evolved into what we now think of as trademark law. The Paul Revere, who got famous, of course, by riding his horse and saying that the British are coming, Paul Revere's day job was as a silversmith, and he had a mark. And you can look it up in a book. You can see the mark that Paul Revere used to put on his products that he made, things that he smithed out of silver. Those earliest marks were always applied to physical goods, durable physical goods. In the hundreds of years that have gone by since the first trademarks, the notion of trademarks has extended far, far beyond the world of durable goods. The world of trademarks has, for over 100 years now, been very clearly and fairly comfortably extended to include service marks, marks directed to services, marks that would communicate the origin of services. I will tell you that in common everyday language, people who do trademark law for a living will usually use the word trademark in a fairly broad sense to include not only marks on goods, but also to cover what you might call service marks, also to cover indications of the origin of services as well. We will briefly, during this lecture series, touch on a few other kinds of marks. For example, certification marks. If you're driving down the highway and you're trying to decide which hotel to go to stay for the night, or which restaurant to go to, maybe you will look for a AAA sign next to the restaurant or the hotel or the motel. Why? Because the AAA people would have inspected it and figured out that it's clean and nice and they charge a reasonable price or whatever. That's a certification mark. The AAA company has a mark, has a trademark registration for the AAA logo to certify that the goods or services, in this case services, restaurant services or hotel services, meet whatever standards are imposed by AAA. There are also collective marks. If you go to buy grape juice, you might buy Welch's grape juice. When I was a little boy, I kind of assumed there must be some place called Welch's where there are a lot of grape vines, and that the Welch's company must harvest these grapes and make juice. Well, what I thought as a little boy turns out not to be correct. Welch's is simply a cooperative owned by grape growers, lots of grape growers, who together sell products under the name Welch's, and Welch's is an indication of the origin of those grapes, and presumably some indication of the quality of those grapes, tied to the many, many members of the association, the cooperative association that is called Welch's. The same is true of Ocean Spray in connection with cranberries. Ocean Spray is not a company that makes all these cranberries. It's an association of cranberry growers who sell their stuff under the name Ocean Spray. Well, there you have a little bit of a background that will permit us to talk about the U.S. trademark application process, and we will go into that in some detail in our next lecture. Thank you.